Find your target. Clear your mind. Now, just don't think of anything except what I'm saying to you.
Hello, everybody. This is Again With This Melrose Place. Today's episode is Season 3, Episode 20, St. Valentine's Day, St. Valentine's Day Massacre. Now, here are your hosts, Tara Ariano and Sarah D. Bundy. Should we redo it?
Nah. Nailed it. Hi, Sarah.
Hello.
The only thing massacred there was...
is the title.
Yeah. Ba-doom-tsh.
Yeah, we haven't done this in 4 weeks, 3 weeks. It's been a while.
It's been a minute.
And by this, we mean Dave talking.
Yeah. I mean, that yesterday.
But... oh, no. Words.
Never mind. For our Patreon, again with this, our next bonus episode is episode 42. It is dropping April 9th. Our topic is, let's ogle vintage Jason Priestley and Luke Perry in a 1992 pictorial in Us Monthly. That makes it sound like they're naked. They're not. You just see their faces.
No.
Is this a story per se? No. Are these hot photos? I think they are. Yeah.
I mean, yeah.
Yeah. It's the topic is they're the 10 hottest bachelors, and like, you know, your mileage may vary with the other eight, and we will definitely get into that.
Oh, but. Yeah. Yeah, we will.
What year is this?
92.
Oh, okay. Because not to cross the streams, but last week in 1988 on A Listen to Sassy, we discovered that John Malkovich apparently is the hottest thing around.
Yeah,
according to
I stared at that Instagram photo array for like 10 minutes and was like, these words don't go together. I am broken.
May
goodbye.
I ask, is John Malkovich still hot in 1992, according to this magazine?
He is not featured in this story.
Order is restored.
No, well, maybe he was considered like too hot to even be in the conversation. It's like, oh, you already know this guy.
Collectively, we are all Icarus and we cannot fly too close to the perfect face that is John Malkovich.
John Malkovicheress. Anyway,
mean, look, in Dangerous Liaisons, I would. He was hot in that.
He's sexy, but that's not what they say. It's in order of cuteness is what they say in Sassy.
Yeah.
And sexy is different than cute, I would posit. But we're getting off track.
Are we avoiding this Melrose episode? Who could say?
Anyway, back to the Patreon. We're going to talk about this Us Monthly article. It was still a monthly back then. You're going to look at the pictures because there will obviously be visual aids. Of course, there will be all 10 of the photos of the bachelors and some relevant pages from elsewhere in the magazine. So if you want to see and hear all that, join us at patreon.com/againwiththis. And if you want to hear that episode of our Sassy podcast, that's Listen to Sassy, listentosassy.com, and on all your podcast platforms. Now, to this episode of Melrose. Starting with our C-plot, Matt's new cop friend does typical shitty cop things copishly.
Speaking of things that have not changed in the last over time.
Oh my God. Ugh. So, Rawlings finds Matt at the hospital and continues being a weird creep in clip number 2.
What are you doing here?
I got a stabbing victim in surgery, had some time, so I figured I'd roam the halls.
In search of?
Dinner partner? It's a great new seafood place over in La Cienega.
Okay, nothing puts me in the mood for some scampi, like, stabbing victim. Why are you like this?
I mean, like, and if you're going to be like this... be 100% like this and suggest something with red sauce. I'm just saying.
Yeah, I was going
to
say.
Do we have to think of everything, Rawlings?
Go to that place where Robert Blake was right before he killed that lady. Now I can't remember the name of that restaurant. Also, that hasn't happened yet in this timeline. Anyway.
Oh, yeah. Fuck.
Matt says he'll probably be eating dinner at his desk because of some computer thing. Doesn't matter. So Rawlings shrugs that it doesn't hurt to ask and takes off. Oh, Matt, do not let this guy see you anywhere else. But of course, that night, he's not at his desk. He's at Shooters with Joe.
He's at the Peach Pit with Steve. Because we've seen this before.
We have. But no, he's at Shooters with Joe, talking about a job that she's up for at LA Monthly. And of course, Rawlings has tracked Matt down there. Matt makes a great, oh, fuck face that you can see in the visual aids.
Yeah.
And Rawlings is like, guess you got off work a little early. And Matt, smiling but not happily, asks how Rawlings found him. But apparently Matt told him about Shooters. And since Rawlings didn't have a date, he thought he would check it out. And cornered into it, Matt tells him to pull up a chair and makes introductions, saying Joe is just telling Matt about this job. And we hear more about that in clip three.
Yeah, LA Monthly's wants me to do a feature photo on the Los Angeles nightlife. The real nightlife.
Down and dirty, huh?
Yeah.
Well, no offense, but you can't get the pictures that you want on your own.
Excuse me?
It's not personal, it's the streets. I mean, you won't get 2 feet inside the territory you need to cover. You're white, you're female, and as far as I can see, you don't have any tattoos or gag symbols. I'll tell you what, luckily, I am the best tour guide on the city payroll. Why don't you come right along with me on my shift?
Really? Oh, God, that would be great.
Sounds dangerous to me.
That should be a lot safer with a cop than she would be on her own. I promise I'll take good care of her.
Since she's white...
Yeah. Also, I mean, we have seen Joe try this before. I mean, in broad daylight, and she got arrested. But also, yuck, he just met her. Like, he doesn't know what she's capable of or what her experience is. Like, is she capable of doing this job safely? No, but he doesn't know that. Anyway.
Well, and also, I don't know, like, if you're trying to sort of blend in with the nightlife, you know what you don't do is roll up in an unmarked Crown Vic with a guy who is obviously a cop.
Right. Yes. I mean, when we're going to see that he's, like, known to all of the, you know, habitués and the places where they go. So it's like, what are you actually seeing that's authentic? Probably nothing, but anyway.
People running away.
Right.
Okay, that makes for great pictures. Right. Not really.
So then he orders another round, and apparently that's all Joe needs to know to think this guy is cool. So then, this is the best. So with her escort, Joe's out shooting on the mean streets directly across the street from Man's Chinese Theater, one of the biggest fucking tourist traps in LA. Like, oh, it's not one of the most beautiful stretches of real estate, and, like, now is even more present day Times Square-ish, but it was, even at the time, it was not unsafe even at night. Like, this right. is absurd. They had movie premieres there, whatever. So a sex worker appears, and Rawlings catcalls her by name, and she, like, gyrates for him, and Joe shoots this woman too, and is convinced that the locals would not let her shoot them like this if Rawlings wasn't there. Again, to our
that's
point.
That's not how.
No.
Not how the underworld works. Thus the word under in it.
Yeah.
Anyway.
But then Rawlings gets a call on his cellular phone about his favorite drug dealer, and off they go. So at the location, he gets his gun out and tells Joe to stay in the car before she can protest he's gone. And when she can hear a distant struggle, she gets out, leaving the car door wide open, by the way, and hides behind some pallets to shoot as Rawlings, like, beats the shit out of a perp.
And you'll see this in the visual aids. Like, there is literally a Billy Joel album cover that is like literally this. It's like a spotlight against a brick wall. Like, this is the central casting alley that does not exist in actual cities. Mm-hmm. It's only on a back lot.
Right.
Is A. B, the fight coordination, the fight choreo is like, my notes read "calm down anyways," because it's so West Side Story. When you're a Rawlings, you're a Rawlings all the way. Like, it's really not sufficiently serious given this issue, but okay.
Right.
Sure. And Joe was like, this is horrifying. I'm like, this is musical theater. What is happening?
Yeah. I mean, I agree. It doesn't rise to the level of, like, The Wire authenticity.
Well,
you know,
I do not expect The Wire authenticity. strangely enough.
Right. It gets the job done for a nighttime soap in whatever year this was. 95, I guess, is where we are. But also, I mean, thank God for the spotlight, because she's shooting at night and from, you know, behind all this stuff that is conveniently placed. So I guess he doesn't see her flashes. But anyway,
right,
when she sees that he's wrapping up, which, like, he pauses to, like, dab at his sweat with a handkerchief, which you can also see in the visual aids. Like,
oh, God,
really ridiculous. So she quickly gets back in the car. And when he joins her, he says he has to get another unit to take her home. And then the next day, Matt's in Joe's apartment looking at all the prints that she made of this police brutality. Matt tells her that Rawlings also menaced Kimberly and why. And he thought it was a one-time thing, like, oh, you thought he was only a violent psychopath abusing state power because he loved you so much? That's sweet.
Oh, Matt.
But,
aren't you a social worker? Don't you know anything?
Honestly. So he asks what Joe's going to do with all of this evidence. And she says she can't afford to get involved since she's just getting her life back together. What? But instead of telling Joe how shitty that is, although his face sure says it, which you can see in the visual aids, he suggests that maybe they shouldn't jump to conclusions. And she suggests maybe this brutal beating, including kicks, was justified. And Matt pretends to agree so that he can leave the conversation. And later, Joe gets a knock on the door, and it's Mark Metcalf.
A pledge pin?
Yes, of Animal House, also the master from Buffy and the maestro from Seinfeld. but here he is, Detective Bob Wilkins of the LAPD's Internal Affairs Division, with another detective who's Detective Banning, no first name. They didn't have time. They were shooting five episodes this week. Anyway, her name was in the sign out log for a ride along with Rawlings the night before, and they discussed that in clip four.
This is very informal. There's no need to be nervous.
A couple of cops show up my door uninvited. I get a little edgy.
With your track record, I could understand why.
What's that supposed to mean?
Nothing, Ms. Reynolds.
I mean, that made me laugh, I have to say.
Yeah. So they know backup was called. Did Joe see anything? She lies that she stayed in the car. They don't seem to believe her, but they leave. And the next day, Joe is panicking, babbling to Matt, trying to figure out which of the IA guys is loyal to Rawlings and whether he possibly saw her. Rawlings, not the IA guy, obviously. And says this, clip five.
I can't count on that. These pictures could get a cop convicted.
In Los Angeles? No, honey. No.
Or anywhere.
I think Google exists
honestly.
Now. Get on Netscape and look for Rodney King.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah. So she thinks she could be next on Rawlings' list. Matt calmly says the photos are evidence, and if she destroys them, she could be an accomplice, which, you know, true, but she did already give a false statement in a police investigation, so. But Matt tells her not to do anything now. She should take some time and think it through. She can leave the photos at his place if she wants, and so she agrees and leaves. And then she's walking home with groceries on what is apparently the most dangerous stretch of sidewalk for the Hollywood area supermarket customer. I'm pretty sure this is the same block where Matt also got roughed up by the people that Kimberly hired.
Think so.
Anyway, Rawlings appears from the shadows and slams her up against a fence or something. He was waiting for her because he felt bad about how hard his guys came down on her. She waves that off, saying they just talked, and he starts spinning, clip six.
About that guy, you know, the one in the alley. He's a drug dealer, Joe. I had him off the streets on a cocaine rap. Stupid parole system popped him out 2 years early.
Look, John.
But the guy's a complete son of a bitch. He came up at me from behind. I decked him. He hit his head. Now the lowlife's in a freaking coma. Can you believe that?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Internal Affairs is all over my ass. They just love drumming up charges on a gay cop. Oh, yeah. Life's no different on the police force, Joe. I'm a walking target. And I was set up on this one.
Look, John, I'm sure you'll work it out. But I have to get going.
You did stay in the car, didn't you, Joe? Because many people stick their noses where they don't belong. They think they see something and they don't know the history behind it. I'm a good cop, Joe. I put my life on the line every night. And this punk might cost me my job. I need to know who my friends are, Joe. Are you my friend?
Of course.
Well,
that's that then.
Yep. I'm sure he's convinced. And yeah,
who
that's
wouldn't
it.
Be? I am.
So she goes home and then drops those groceries immediately because the place has been tossed. And when she gets to the damage in the bathroom slash dark room, she starts blubbering, except it's a soap and they didn't have time for a second take. So it's fully just the dry cries. As you can see in the visual aids, there's a gif of her completely tearless face. And it's pretty funny.
Get the blower.
Get the blower. Fly in the blower. If you listen to our Patreon episodes about 90210 OMG, that will make sense. We have two more plot lines to get to, but first, we have a message for Katie Nolfi.
We are told by a different Dave that Katie can name every owner of the Peach Pit after dark in sequential order. As the co-author responsible for the too mega to fail sidebar in our very special 90210 book, which addressed the various P-Pad ownership concerns and their varying degrees of ineptitude, I feel both very seen and very sad for Katie that this information is taking up space in not one, but two sets of gray matter.
For Katie's birthday, in an effort to drive that information out, we've made a list of five individuals or outfits who would have done, if it's possible to imagine, an even worse job managing the After Dark than the canonical Doofy.
Number one, Billy McFarland and Ja Rule try to stage a comeback with the Paid Festival, spelled, of course, P-A-Y-D.
Oh, boy. Number two, Anna Sorokin leverages her social media influence and the writer's room's ignorance of how wire transfers work to turn the Peach Pit After Dark into an arts foundation, not despite but because of Colin's hideous mural somehow.
Number three, Lindsay Lohan expands the club's operations to an outpost in Ibiza, finances it with a reality show contract, and lets her parents run the original franchise.
Number four, David Miscavige reimagines the space as Peach Org, Scientology's Center for Musical Study. Rumors that his wife Shelley is confined to a pigeon coop on the roof are not only scurrilous, but will be met with litigation.
And finally, last and least, the restless ghost of Bruce Teller, who is about as good at managing a rock club from beyond the veil as he was running D&D on this side of it. Katie, we, and Dave, hope you don't find this list too haunting.
Eh. Ooh.
We know we're late, but we hope you had a fantastic birthday.
Happy birthday, Katie! On to the B plot. All eyes are on Amanda, even during chemo. In her hospital bed, Amanda's on the corded phone scheduling meetings in her paper planner because it is the past. Michael comes in to check on her and warn her that after the procedure she's about to have, she's not going to feel like doing anything, never mind more work. But she seems to be under the impression that outpatient procedure means you will feel 100% afterward. Michael is like, it's chemotherapy.
Consumed any pop culture, including chemo. That's so weird. Anyway.
Yeah. But Amanda ignores that and says she wants the rest of her appointment scheduled for first thing in the morning so she can get herself together before work. Michael tries again to tell her to take it easy, but she just picks up the phone again. So, message not received. And at D&D, a delivery person parades through the bullpen with a giant floral arrangement, and Allison whines that the Valentine's Day bullshit is starting early this year. I'm paraphrasing. Billy philosophically says that's something they don't need to worry about this year, which doesn't seem to be a comfort to her, but he thinks Valentine's Day is the dumbest holiday of all time. I still think it's Thanksgiving, but Valentine's Day is also stupid.
Yep.
Amanda walks in just then, whereupon Billy suggests maybe the two of them should get her something. Allison agrees and then probably regrets it immediately. Clip 7.
Bob McGovern says you submitted material directly to him.
He wanted to check the artwork.
But I haven't approved the copy. As much as you like to think you run D&D, nothing leaves this office without my authorization.
You're right, Amanda. I'm sorry. Listen, I was just gonna go get a cup of tea. Maybe I can bring one for you too. No sugar, right?
I should have known. Get in my office now, both of you.
No sugar, indeed.
Like, I mean, this is shitty, but Amanda, you did this to yourself. Do not ever tell Billy anything.
Yeah.
Honest to God, it really was a tactical error on her part for someone who's supposed to be scheme central.
Yeah, well, and this person physically, literally can't keep his mouth closed. Why would he be any better at it metaphorically? I ask you.
But also, nice poker face, Allison. You can just whine about whatever for appearances' sake. Like, duh.
Seriously, you could actually see the gears grinding. She's like, I should try to be nicer to Amanda. She is a sick. Oh, yeah. Allison.
So in Amanda's office, Allison does at least try to play dumb, but is not convincing. And Billy says he had to tell Allison what was going on, given that everyone else has had to pick up the slack while Amanda's been out of the office getting, you know, cancer treatment. Like, he doesn't say it in a shitty way, but still, this is Amanda, and it's not what she wants to hear, considering how she's probably been endangering her health, pushing herself too hard even to try to keep up. So Allison and Billy both try to get her to understand she needs to designate a deputy, at least temporarily, and she essentially tells them to fuck off. At the beach house, Michael and Kimberly have just finished having some classic under all the covers sex. Kimberly griping that just once she'd like to celebrate the holiday, meaning Valentine's, on the actual day, but at least they're on the schedule together, supposedly. And then the phone rings. It's Amanda sounding rough and asking for Michael. Kimberly airily says he's busy, but when Michael hears Kimberly repeat Amanda's name, he snatches the phone away. Amanda cries that she's been sick for hours and she's scared. Michael will be there in 20 minutes, which no, he won't. He lives in Malibu. But anyway, Kimberly is not about it in clip 8.
Since when do you make house calls?
Since I have a friend who's very ill.
Please, Michael, you don't have friends.
Gee, I wonder why. Don't start with me, Kim. She's my patient. Stay out of it.
And then Marcia Cross makes the first in a series of asshole says what crazy faces that is so good. She is having the time of an actor's life, and I'm very happy for her.
Me too.
Even years later.
Yes. But I'm also like, you don't have any friends. Bitch, neither do you. Neither of you have any friends.
Yeah.
It's mean. At Amanda's, Michael unpacks Sprite. Not that he calls it that. What he calls soda crackers, but are the rather upmarket stoned wheat thins.
Yeah.
I approve, though. They are,
I mean, they are delicious,
superior.
But yeah.
And Compazine, the anti-nausea prescription Amanda had bravely said she would not need. She even tries to refuse the Sprite. Bitch, it's Sprite. Although Michael could have brought diet if he wanted to avoid another fight. Just saying. And he gets impatient. Clip 9.
Amanda, we can ease your pain physically. But mentally, you can't keep denying you're sick.
You think I don't know that? I want to get better, but I'm just not going to give up everything else.
You don't have to prove anything. Taking nausea pills because you're sick is not a sign of weakness. And resting after chemo is not lazy, it's smart. Well, you have everything you need now, so I guess I better be going.
Do you have to? Can't you just stay for a little while till I fall asleep?
Sure.
I guess this is supposed to be the start of what pays off at the end of the next episode, which I won't spoil, but I don't really buy it.
I have a note about this, actually, that at the time, like, you could see what this was rounding towards. And,
sure.
Like, we were all about it for some reason. It was, like, so bizarre that it worked. But it doesn't work as well for me now, and I'm not sure why.
Yeah. So the next day, Kimberly rages up to Michael in the lounge to complain that he didn't tell her about Amanda's lymphoma. He reminds her he didn't have to tell her anything because of doctor-patient confidentiality, but clip 10.
You are not trained for this, Michael. What you are doing is unethical.
When did unethical sneak into your vocabulary?
Michael, she needs a specialist.
You think I'm making this up as I go along? Oncology's been on board since Amanda was diagnosed. She's had a CAT scan and a biopsy. Amanda happens to feel comfortable with me as her attending physician.
Well, isn't that sweet? So what's in it for you?
Just the joy of living with a wife who's pissed off 24 hours a day. And if by some miracle Amanda survives, maybe just the break I need around here.
Okay.
I guess. I don't know.
Yeah.
This also feels like, you know, moving chess pieces into place that never, still don't really make sense, but fine.
It sure does. And okay. Like, at least they're moving. That's fine.
True. And over to D&D, a little wind-up heart toy skips on its feet across Amanda's desk.
Locklear's face during this scene is classic.
Yeah.
So good.
They cut, I mean, this is all in the visual aids. They cut from the toy to her face, and she's like, uh-huh. And then to Billy and Allison being like, right? Like, they're so proud of themselves for spending $1.99 on this shit at, like, it's CVS. Yeah.
You would get it out of the gum machine in the front of CVS. It's, yeah. But Locklear is like, so this is a, like, you're fucking with me, right? And they're like, isn't it cute? See how it's hopping? And she's like, wait, what is this? I mean, it really is a poem, her face, mm-hmm. and it'll be in the visual aids.
Yes. When she smiles for real, she, you know, it's like when you turn it, when she turns it on, you remember why she had a career in TV for 25 years. Like, she's just, she is dazzling. She's such a star.
Yeah. And subtle, too. I think she doesn't get enough credit for how much she can get into a smile that is like that megawatt. So, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Anyway, she thanks them for thinking of her. But when they're gone, she just slams her hand down on the toy. Like
it's a bug. It's so good.
Yes. Fuck this corny shit. Anyway, at the hospital, Michael is also slamming things, but it's the phone. Matt asks what's wrong, and without naming names, Michael says he needs to figure out how to get through to an intractable patient before she dies. He had a line on a research program in New York, but the doctor in charge says it's full. But Matt knows sometimes full means they're being selective, so Michael should try again and push. And that night, Billy shows up at Allison's door with a bowl of popcorn and two videos, saying just because they aren't a couple doesn't mean they can't spend Valentine's Day together. Her choices are The Dirty Dozen and Sleepless in Seattle, clip 11.
12 convicts forced to serve in a hellish war, or two lovers who manage to seek each other out. And it's Valentine's, I guess. We have to go with The Dirty Dozen.
This joke has a bell on it, but she makes it work.
She does. She does. And I think it especially because it's Allison, it works even better. Like, that was completely Courtney Thorne Smith in that moment. But yep. I'm fine with that. We stand, as you all know. Mm-hmm.
Billy says she always was a good video date. He has also brought one rose with baby's breath. He just wanted her to know she's special. And she gives him a big hug. And it is actually sweet. I'm sorry.
Yeah. He also brought an absolute unit bowl of popcorn.
Yeah, the bowl of popcorn is huge.
Yeah. No issues with Billy here or Allison for once. Let's enjoy it. Mm-hmm.
So the next day, Michael shows up at D&D. Amanda hisses at him that she's going to have a hard time keeping her condition secret when he keeps showing up all the time. But he says he has bad news from her latest tests. Her white count is low. And though the treatment she's on is the best available on the West Coast, there's this research study in New York. She meets every criterion for it, but they're going to have to go in the back door and basically stalk this Dr. Steele until he enrolls her. And Amanda doesn't love it, but she is convinced. So they're going to go on the fake road to fake New York. And we will see that in the next episode. Finally, our A plot. Jane and Jake try to bust Sydney out of her cult. So, of course, we remember how we left Sydney stuck in a box in the ground. And that's where we find her after the sun has come up and Martin is opening the hatch back up with a huge smile on his face. Sydney does not look so happy as he pulls her out, crabbing that she could have died down there, which seems a little melodramatic, although, you know, I'm sure she wasn't happy, but he laughs that off in clip 12.
Don't give me that much credit, Sydney. You control your life. You allowed this to happen. I provided options. You made the decision not to write the letter.
Okay, but after she made that decision, she was like, I'm going to go. And he was like, bye. So I hope this doesn't work on her. But of course, I fear it will because
I think it's actually quite well written in terms of the way that guys like that will turn shit around.
True.
That way. I thought it was actually pretty good. And speaking of The Wire, now I have the theme song stuck in my head. Down in the hole.
Yeah. I mean, the reason that you put someone in way down in the hole is to scramble their thinking, make sure they're not sleeping, like put them back cruel, on their heels.
Cruel and unusual.
Exactly. Yep. Yeah. So she looks back toward the road as Martin pretends again that she has the option to choose whether to stay or leave. She asks whether anyone's ever changed their mind about staying. And of course, he says no, because he is a cult leader. And she thinks maybe she just isn't strong enough to stay, which gives him the perfect opening. Clip 13.
You wouldn't be here if you didn't have incredible inner strength. Your life in Los Angeles was dreadful, but it was familiar. It's very difficult to leave a comfortable place. Even if it is hell, it takes great courage.
Never thought of it that way. Sometimes you make things so clear.
Well, that's because you're willing to listen. So, what's it gonna be? Long walk into the desolate unknown? Or breakfast?
Okay, breakfast.
I mean, when you put it like that. Can I pile some eggs on a biscuit and then hit the desolate unknown road? Is that an option?
Yeah, except I was thinking about it like, you know, breakfast is always the right answer, no matter the time of day also, by the way.
True.
But, you know, at this fucking joint, breakfast is going to be some kind of vegan bullshit. Like,
oh, God, yeah. A handful of twigs and a scorpion tail. Like, you know,
yeah,
I'm just going to call a Lyft. It's fine.
Mm-hmm. So back at the complex, Jane and her much better hair. I'm in love with her hair in this episode. There's like 15 shots of it in the visual aids.
Yeah, it's really good. And even when there's like my nemesis, the claw clip, it still is perfect. Like it's like sort of zhuzhed up with that dry shampoo. Man, yes, that was Bob goals back then for sure.
Yep. Anyway, she and this great hair go to Jake's to see what he knows about Sydney's whereabouts, which turns out to be nothing. She says she thinks Ricky got Sydney involved in a cult and asks if he knows anything about Martin, which, of course, he does because Sydney has said it many times. Sydney's probation officer looked Martin up. Clip 14.
The cult information hotline lists him as extremely destructive.
I want this to be a real thing so bad.
I want a 23-part podcast on the cult information hotline.
Me too.
Because I
would settle for like just a like the imagining of the voicemail menu for the cult information.
Why don't you just tell me the name of the cult leader you're asking about?
To speak to Chris, dial 0.
Yeah. Also, what happens? Like, is there anyone that they say is not extremely destructive? Like, is there anyone they're like, oh, they're moderately destructive? Or, you know, do they just
they can
say,
act like fools at the airport, but they're probably harmless.
Right.
Mildly destructive. Oh, God.
I have 5 billion questions about this. But anyway, this is how you found shit out before the internet, I guess. But anyway. Jake then proves he didn't really spend a lot of time getting to know Sydney when they were dating. Clip 15.
Sydney's missing a few bricks, but she's too smart to fall for that line of crap.
Cults prey on vulnerability. Sid's a perfect target. I mean, she might be a liar, but she's no thief, and she cares too much about material things to destroy them.
You don't think she trashed my bar?
I don't know. But if Sydney didn't do it, someone set her up.
I mean, yeah. Sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, like, just the idea that Sydney is too smart to get involved in, like, a shady operation. Like, you know, she was a sex worker in a, you know, some kind of a lady's stable not very long ago. Like, Sydney has a need to belong. This is something we already knew about her. Get with it, Jake.
Yeah.
So then Jane says she's going to call and see if maybe they can tell her where they went. They who? Like, Sydney doesn't have any of their friends or contacts. I have no idea who she's calling. But anyway, Jake still does not seem totally convinced, but now he is concerned, tells Jane to keep him posted. So back at the retreat, Sydney and Ricky watch as Martin does target practice on some bottles set up on a fence or something. He takes a break to eat and offers to let Sydney try the gun, which she declines, but he insists, sending her into a shed to pick out a weapon she likes. And when she does, she gasps at the sight of all the firepower accumulated there and then carefully brings out a handgun as Martin explains that they keep the guns for defense. And just the sight of them makes most people mind their own business. He instructs her on how to shoot. And she hits a bottle on her first try, and everyone celebrates. And then at the Halfway House Cafe Roadhouse, I feel we have seen on the Starverse shows many times before.
Pretty sure this is where Jake met his dad.
That's what I thought. I think that's right.
Yeah. It was the curtains that tipped me off, but who knows?
Yeah. Jane and Jake, for they have decided to go on the road together. Jake checks the map and says he and Jane aren't going to make it to the Abbott Way compound, which is apparently outside Tucson, before nightfall. And she is just gazing at him in quiet adoration. And when he asks, what's up? She says she just can't believe he's being so great after the way she treated him when he tried to warn her about Chris, which, by the way, Chris.
Where is that guy? Does he work at this cafe? It would be so funny to me if they just pass someone who's hitchhiking and it's like obviously Chris based on the shape of his out of control hair, but then nobody says anything about it. It's just like Waldo or Hitchcock.
Or in the Halfway House Cafe, like he got halfway back to L.A. and like stopped and got a job as a busboy. And he's like coming out to clear a table and is like, oh, fuck. And like ducks back in.
He just like drops to the ground and crawls out. You hear him muttering. Oh, my God. It will never die. This joke will be onto another show completely.
Anyway. Jane also regrets having pushed Sydney away, and Jake says Jane had cause to disbelieve Sydney, but Jane says if anything happens to her, she will never forgive herself. And then we're at the compound after dark. Everyone is running around in a panic as Ricky tells Sydney, traffic, meaning headlights approaching. And it is, of course, Jane and Jake, the former saying this, clip 16.
I can't believe Sydney's out here. When we were kids, she wouldn't even go camping. Her idea of roughing it was a black and white TV.
I mean...
Yeah.
Hashtag justice for Sydney.
Right.
For a bunch of reasons.
Mm-hmm. So Sydney recognizes Jane's car and Martin tells her to get rid of her. And when Jane leaps out of the car, Sydney holds her hands up in the classic Oprah hug dodge move, which you can see in the visual aids, like pushing her away. And then this happens, clip 17.
Let me guess. You're just in the neighborhood and you stop by for a drink?
We came here to make sure you were all right.
Like you give a damn, Jake. You're probably here to blame me for something else I didn't do.
Sydney, I was really worried. You left so suddenly.
Gee, like there were so many fabulous reasons for me to stay. You know, leave me alone.
Hey. You have 9 hours, okay? Talk to your sister.
Excuse me, but Sydney's quite capable of deciding who she talks to and when. There's really no reason for concern. Sydney's happy here. She has a job, many friends, which, from what I understand, are things you two took away from her.
Sydney, get in the car.
For God's sake, give me some credit for once, will ya? I finally found people who love me for who I am. For starters, they don't judge me, like you and Dudley do right here.
Sydney.
Jake, get the hell away from me, okay? Believe it or not, I'm over you, and it's a lot easier when you're not in my face all the time. Jane, do us all a favor and leave, okay? This is my home now. It may not be Camelot, but it is the home I've always dreamed of. Sydney, are you sure? Yes, I need to stay.
I love Jake getting offended at Dudley Do-Right. Like, hey, eyes on the prize, Jake. Come on.
Yeah. So he's Canadian. Calm down.
By the way, while this is happening, Ricky and another guy are drawing guns on Jake when he grabs Sydney's arm, because, of course, that's what he does. And there's a warning look in Sydney's eyes, which you can see in the visual aids. I can't tell if Jane is a good enough sister to detect it or if Josie Bassett is a good enough actor to indicate that she does. But either way, Jake and Jane get back in the car and peel out, Martin congratulating Sydney as they go for getting stronger every day. And then back at the complex, Jake is trying to get Jane in her low-key great outfit, which you can see in the visual aids, mm-hmm. like long coat, leggings, scarf, knee-high boots. Love everything about it. Mm-hmm. Again, Jane flawlessly styled in almost every scene of this episode.
True.
Trying to get her to stop feeling guilty about the way things went down in Arizona. Like, what did you just spend the last 9 hours talking about in the car? Like,
seriously. It's a big state.
Yeah. But anyway, he says it was Sydney's choice to stay, but Jane can't shake the feeling that they missed something. This is, by the way, where I noticed that Grant Show dyed his hair at some point. It looks awful. It's really dark. I think it's even darker than it was. Yeah, it's you can see it in the visual aids. And I looked it up. I'm guessing this was so that he could play undercover cop Steve Ali Kulura in the TV movie Between Love and Honor, a.k.a. Kulura colon actor with a gun, based on a true story about a guy who infiltrated the Gambino crime family, but then fell in love with his daughter, Maria. It came out in 1995. Yes, it is available to stream online, so we may talk about it in a future Patriot episode.
Oh, we will for sure be talking about it, because I actually, in my true crime bookshop, sell the book written by that guy.
Well, I have it bookmarked, so let me know when you want me to send that over to you, because it's on YouTube.
I will pull that out of stock and we can do some research.
Fantastic.
Crossover event.
Ooh. Anyway, apparently Jane did not pick up on Sydney's pointed look, but she did pick up on something. Clip 18.
It wasn't her actions or the way she looked. It was something she said. She said this was her home. Something else. This is my home. This is my home.
It may not be Camelot.
And believe me, Sydney's always wanted to live a lush life. That's it. She said it was the home she'd always dreamed of.
Right.
But it's not. The home she dreamed of was right next to me. She always wanted us to live near each other.
How many people went on that retreat?
The woman at Martin's house said about 20. Why?
We didn't see anybody but Sydney and Martin. Where was everyone? I'll get someone to cover shooters for me.
That's okay, Jake. I can handle this by myself.
I know you can. I'm not going to let you. Let's go save Sydney's butt.
I mean, I just wish they had done that. There were so many more elegant ways to write that so that Sydney had managed to tell Jane something. And then, like, just go to the halfway cafe, order a coffee from Chris. And like, be like, well, you know, she said this, which means she's in trouble.
Yeah.
It's like, maybe we won't be neighbors, but this is my home. And then like a shot of Josie Bassett cocking a brow. They get in the car. They leave. Yeah. They have this conversation by the state line instead of getting all the way home. Like, it's just I don't know. This show is usually better at this stuff than that. Like, it can be too neat, but this is just like first drafty. Like, they just need to rewrite it.
Agree. So then it's 9 more hours later, and Ricky is telling Sydney that her can't take a hint sister is back. Martin gets a gun out. Sydney begs him not to shoot them, but Martin says he won't. Sydney will, unless she can get them to leave for good. It is up to her to maintain the community. Sydney says she just needs to talk to Jane alone. So when Jane runs up to her this time, Sydney jams her gun in Jane's ribs. Clip 19.
Sydney, what are you doing with the gun? Saving your damn life. Why did you come back?
I won't let you ruin my life again, Jane. Get in the car.
both of you.
She mouths, "Go, please go."
I don't ever want to see you again, you understand? This is my life. Stay the hell out of it. Move it, Jake!
So then, as they turn around, Sydney turns and shoots out the tires on the bus. And Ricky runs back into the trailer to arm herself, but Sydney shoots at the trailer as well, while Martin just stands there. And then, clip 20.
Adios, fruitcake!
Oh. Welcome to the soundboard, clip 20.
Oh,
adios,
boy.
To fruitcakes.
So good.
Yeah.
And this is what I'm saying. Like, this was perfectly set up by everything else in the episode. There was
right.
just that one sort of like clank thing that mm-hmm. needed to, they just need to close that loop a little bit.
Yeah.
But like, oh, Sydney can actually shoot. Huh.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. Like, duly noted. They've set that up and then this happens. I don't know.
Right. So, yeah, Sydney leaps into the back of the convertible and they peel out. Ricky comes back out with a rifle, but Martin stops her and says they'll take care of Sydney another time. Like, why bother? She is broke. They have established that she is not in contact with her apparently rich dad. Like, just let her, who cares? Like, let this one go.
Yeah, really. But, I mean, you know, May sweeps. I guess we'll find out why they're bothering.
I guess. The next morning, Jane pops by Jake's to check in. Sydney's fine. They spent a lot of time talking. She fell asleep on Jane's couch. She thanks him for taking 2 days out of his life to help someone he barely knows, which, like, true, but the show rarely acknowledges this. Like, you know, they have known each other, but it's not like this is their first storyline together, really.
Yeah, probably.
So when he steps out, they exchange a significant look that she breaks by offering to make him dinner that night. Just to thank you for a friend, but he watches her butt walk away in a more than friendly way.
Mm-hmm.
And that night, Sydney's on her couch reading next to the phone/answering machine when Ricky calls. And because it's the past, she can hear the message as Ricky leaves it. She and Martin are going away for a while, but Sydney should be patient. They know in their hearts that Sydney wants to be with them and they'll be back for her. And Sydney gets up to go tell Jane about the call, but of course stops when she looks through the window and sees Jane pouring Jake wine and flirtatiously hand-feeding him. Everything Ricky and Martin said about Sydney's life in L.A. was true.
Done.
In a sense, I guess. And that's the end of the episode. Let us name our MVP. Sydney.
Yeah. I mean,
Annie Oakley,
Chris,
over here,
continuing to evade capture for a record 78th episode in a row. Just kidding. Yeah, Sydney, for sure. I mean, adios, you fruitcakes. Sure.
Least valuable player. Still John, you know, the police brutaliter.
Yeah. But, I mean, usually we're spoiled for choice with this, and everyone was actually pretty okay this episode.
Well, I mean, I'm going to give honorable mention to Allison, you know, totally tipping her hand about knowing about Amanda's cancer diagnosis by
being
such a dumbass.
Well, and also being a simpleton who thinks a jumping heart is hilarious. But, I mean, that gave me joy, that scene, so I'll let it go.
Yeah. And that's it.
Next time on Again With This, sisters are doing Jake for themselves, or trying to, the LAPD continues covering itself in non-glory, and when the Amanda's away, the mice will fuck everything up. Speaking of fucked up, that's probably going to be your corneas after you check out our visual aids, which you can find for this and every other episode of Again With This at our website, againwiththispodcast.com. That's also where you can find links to our very special 90210 book, illustrated by Julie Kane. That won't hurt your cornea at all, so browse on over there today. You can also follow us on Twitter at AWT90210 and join our Patreon page at patreon.com/againwiththis. Any level of support gets you extra content. I'm surprisingly accessible gunshed, Sarah D. Bunting, and I'm on Twitter at Tomato Nation. My co-host is cult information hotline truther, Tara Ariano, and she's on Twitter at Tara Ariano. And our producer is artfully lit beatdown David T. Cole. Talk to you next time.
Adios, fruitcake!
This replaces me doing that banjo noise. I am all for it.